couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Ant-Man and the Wasp, The First Purge, Whitney, and the 50th anniversary of Yellow Submarine. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The China Hustle and The Cured. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The piece of news that has kind of caught my eye this week is Scarlett Johansson has come under fire because she's going to be cast as a trans man in a new movie, which I don't even know if I can say the title of this on the radio. But they're going after Scarlett Johansson because she's not a trans man. She's a cis woman. I mean, that's just who she is. And they're saying you should get a real trans person to play the role, at least, and ideally a trans man. And there are trans actresses out there. Now, if you remember that movie Tangerine a couple of years ago did have a trans actress in it. And Laverne Cox, of course, is a trans actress who was Frankenfurter in the Fox TV remake of Rocky Horror Picture Show. So it's not that we haven't had trans actors on screen. I do think that the criticism is a little unfair. As much as I support the trans community and as much as I support the LGBT community as a whole, this is also a business decision. There aren't a whole lot of trans actors or actresses out there that are at even close to a name like Scarlett Johansson. There's very few actresses out there who are Scarlett Johansson level. I mean, you're talking about her in like the top 10 actresses that you would cast. Now, of course, you could counter that by saying, well, you know, trans actors aren't given the opportunity. And that's true. But there's also a lot to be said about star power and star image. It's like when Scarlett Johansson was cast in Ghost in the Shell a couple years ago. That was a business decision. And they said, well, she's playing an Asian character. But, I mean, there are Asian actresses out there, but none at the level of Scarlett Johansson. I mean, if you had done that maybe 10, 15 years ago, you could have cast Lucy Liu in that role. And occasionally we have a name or a well-known actress or something like that, but they're going by star power. That was not a bad decision by Paramount to cast Scarlett Johansson in anything, really. Now, granted, the movie didn't do terribly well, but I think that has more to do with the fact that it's this obscure cyberpunk based on a manga that a relatively small number of people, especially in the States, had even known about. And I think that had more to do with the movie not being something that connected with an audience than people rejecting Scarlett Johansson as not an Asian character. So I think that the whole trans thing and making such a big deal of it online and people getting so upset about it kind of works against whatever recognition and acceptance you have in movies. I mean, you're talking about people wanting to go 0 to 60. And this is just a sad fact of life. The whole trans community concept and the whole just understanding who they're, that's a very new concept. That is something that a lot of people are either unfamiliar with, let alone comfortable with. And that doesn't mean that that's okay, but you're dealing with, you know, you cast a trans actor in a motion picture. You want to have some sort of crossover mainstream appeal. You're going to get a lot of people just not going to see it. And I guess the question is it better for the community to, like when Felicity Huffman did the movie Trans America, is it better to have a well-known actress like her that can raise a profile of an issue, or is it that important to have a specific actor or trans actor who is not well-known, who won't get any sort of buzz from the movie? It's also like when Jeffrey Tambor, let's ignore all the whole Me Too stuff and him being sort of acerbic to work with, when he was cast in Transparent, and there's a lot of people who were upset that it was a straight cis male who's in this role instead of a trans actor. Jeffrey Tambor has a bigger career. If you want to talk about sort of like LGBT roles in history, and you can go all the way back to stuff like Bride of Frankenstein with James Whale and his directing approach. But, you know, even like if you talk about this generation, I remember back in the 70s on TV and in movies, all the gay characters were just straight up either gay or you'd have a lesbian and they were all roaring stereotypes. I remember there was the one character in Barney Miller, even Three's Company, you had Jack Tripper and there was all the gay jokes on that side. So having just a regular gay character in TV or movies, like a Will and Grace character, like Will, not Jack, but Will, who's just a regular guy who just happens to be gay without all the huge stereotypes, there's an evolution to get to that point. And I think what happened is once people started to put real trans actors in movies, you got to let the rest of the public get acclimated to it before you start making further and further demands. And that's just the way things are. This is how society evolves. And yeah, I'd love to just snap my fingers a la Thanos and make things accepted, but you're not going to get that. And so if you're going to have a movie about trans characters, yeah, you're going to be casting cis straight actors in those roles. And that's just the fact of life. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit comes out at the end of August, and this is Destination Wedding. Opens on August 24th and stars Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder.
What brings you to Paso Robles?
I'm going to the destination wedding.
Please don't tell me it's Keith and Nance.
So we're just the people you don't know where to stick?
You might as well just stick us together.
I don't want to be a person you don't know where to stick.
Destination wedding is presumptuous. They're in a fool's paradise.
Don't you believe there's someone for everyone?
Close. I believe that there's nobody for anyone.
First of all, it's kind of amazing that these two have never kind of been paired up before. Because they're kind of both from the same generation. This movie looks a lot like, I think it was Table 19 a couple of years ago. That one starred Anna Kendrick and June Squibb and Stephen Merchant, a bunch of the random people at a wedding just kind of shoved together at a table. This seems to be the same thing. These just both seem like horrible people that it's like, oh, isn't it cute that they're both acerbic and bad people and annoying and they're going to find love. And I don't know, when you get in your 40s and you're that bitter about life and the world, it's kind of hard for me to really get behind that. I don't know. We'll see. It might be charming and fun, but I kind of just cringe to that whole trailer. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Grinch, which opens on November 9th.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. Today, we will do mean things, and we will do them in style. I know what to do. I'm going to steal their Christmas.
This is the Illumination animation reboot of The Grinch. This does not have anything to do with the 2000 Jim Carrey movie, which was horrible. My biggest problem with this one is it looks like it's going to fall into the same problems because The Grinch, what you ran into with any of these Dr. Seuss movies that you expand to a full-length feature, Horton Hears a Who I think worked. But some of these other ones, this is my problem with The Lorax, is it took a relatively self-contained, very simple story and it has to flesh it out to a two-hour or at least an hour-and-a-half movie. And it kind of ruins it by adding too much other characters and story to it. And that's kind of the problem with The Grinch that they did with the Jim Carrey movie is The Grinch wasn't just there to be grumpy and mean. That's the whole point, is that there's no explanation as to why. Once you start throwing in an explanation as to why he's grumpy and mean and hates the Whos and wants to steal their Christmas, it makes them out to be a bunch of jerks. And that's the way they were in that original movie. So it looks like this has got a little bit of that in there. And I don't know. It's going to be better than the Jim Carrey movie because that thing was frightening. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The First Purge and Yellow Submarine's 50th anniversary.
We'll be right back.
Two Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews for this week. The first one I want to talk about is The First Purge. In this prequel to the Purge film series, we see the first purge conducted as an experiment on Staten Island, in which one night is chosen for all crimes to be legal.
Citizens, this will be a tradition we celebrate every year. Join the First Purge.
People are now calling this controversial experiment of legalized crime the Purge.
You and Isaiah, just stay with me during the Purge.
Oh, we're going to be fine on our own.
We are here with Dr. May Updale.
She came up with this experiment. Is the Purge a political device?
It is a psychological one. If we want to save our country, we must release all our anger in one night.
Tonight, we'll see the good and evil in everyone.
First of all, there's a certain political element to these movies, and that certainly kind of exploded in 2016 when the Purge election year came out. It was obviously spinning off of the current election at the time. The first Purge movie, which came out with Ethan Hawke, the one that started this franchise, was pretty much a self-contained take on the home invasion thriller. And they, of course, have gotten bigger and trying to cover more ground in terms of the socio-political ramifications of it, for better or for worse in this film series. But the last two movies, this one, which is released on the 4th of July, and the last one, which was during the election year of 2016, have obviously been trying to capitalize on just sort of the mood of the country and tying it to some sort of political relevance. So it came out on the 4th of July, technically Tuesday night, actually, because they always do preview showings the night before. And it had a pretty good Wednesday number, but we'll see how it rolls out through the weekend, because it may have burned off most of its demand and high audience in that first day or two, which is not uncommon on a film like this. But this one takes place before all the other ones does. It's when the Purge is in its infancy, when they're just trying it out. And they, of course, set up with the new founding fathers have created this idea. It's very clear that they have the new founding fathers basically wanted to not purge the emotions of the country, but rather to purge the poor and disenfranchised and those that they see as a sponge off of society rather than what it's being sold as a chance to purge your emotions. There's a couple differences between these and the other films. I thought always of the first three, the first one was the strongest because it was the original idea. It wasn't known it was going to become kind of a phenomenon. But then the next two were kind of terrible. And part of the reason is that it's so one-dimensional in its thinking, the entire Purge series, because it's all crimes illegal up to and including murder. And they immediately stampede towards murder. And here's the thing. There's a lot more crimes you can commit that can have a lasting effect, if you murder somebody, okay, they're gone. But there's other crimes you can commit to permanently damage somebody. And they ignore all those and just stampede towards murder. Now, this film actually takes a nod at a couple crime elements that can be beyond just murder and overall vandalism. But they just sort of breeze by those and they still come back to, oh, there's going to be murder. A more creative person could really explore this from a psychological level, and it never is in this series. With that said, they have a new director on this movie, and at the very least, the filmmaking element of it, the cinematography and the setup and the construction of the look of the movie follows a greater horror movie base. And that makes it more interesting to watch for sure. Cause there's like a scene where these people are walking around with these contacts because the new founding fathers pay people to experience the Purge, and they have these contacts that they can then broadcast back to them. So they walk around with these glowing blue eyes because that's what the contacts do. And that makes some really interesting cinematic elements to the movie. But ultimately, this does still have a one-dimensional thought process of where this would go when it could really be fully explored. And it's very straw man are oriented, where the founding fathers, there's not a whole lot of subtlety to who people represent in real life. The only real noticeable person in this movie is Marissa Tomei's in it. She plays the psychologist who first came up with the idea of the Purge. These movies do kind of turn into violence porn anyways, and that's why I've never particularly liked them. And that's also why I thought the first movie of The Purge was more interesting because it wasn't just about the violence that you can show on screen. It was more of, like I said, the home invasion. Will they get in the house or will they not? This one is marginally better than the last two because, and I'm going to give it actually a pass on a couple things because they at least think a little deeper, but it still just kind of turns into kind of a silly movie. These movies never have gone where they could go. And when I say other crimes, I'm not talking about cheating on your taxes while jaywalking or something like that, which is what I would do. I mean, that would be a great way to stick it to the man. But there's a lot of other things. Just use your imagination. And this could get very dark fast. And that's, I think, why they have to go one-dimensionally. Because if you think beyond that, it gets very dark and just gets in the way of telling an actual story. Because ultimately, the process will break down. So I'm really on the fence on this one, whether I'm saying kind of sucks or kind of rocks. I was originally going to give it a kind of rocks because at least it's different and it's better than the last two, but I think I still have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Yellow Submarine. The Beatles star in this animated feature about the fun-loving people of Pepperland under assault by the music-hating creatures known as the Blue Meanies.
The forces of good, the Beatles. The forces of evil, the arch-villain, the Blue Meanie.
Look at John, will ya?
What's the matter, John, love? Blue Meanies?
Newer and bluer meanies have been sighted within the vicinity of this theatre. There's only one way to go out.
How's that?
Singing!
One, two,
three,
four!
We all live in a yellow submarine. Yellow submarine.
What's interesting about Yellow Submarine is the fact that it is so trippy to begin with. And it's almost billed as a kid's movie, the way they set it up, because back then animated, you know, yeah, you had Ralph Bakshi doing stuff like Fritz the Cat at that time, but this was still kind of made almost as a kid's movie because it's animated. People think, oh, animated cartoons, this thing is trippy as all get out. It's totally psychedelic. And it's not very subtle. I mean, they have bits with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and it's literally a woman with diamonds in her hair. And you're like, no, you're talking about LSD. We all know that. That's nothing new. At the very least, it's an interesting film. It's not real close to my heart. I'm one of those people who's more of an Elvis fan than a Beatles fan, but I respect the music. It's coming back to theaters in a remastered print. If you've never seen it on the big screen, it is kind of a big screen movie for as grand and bizarre as the animation is. It's out there and at times silly. And also at times, it's just imagery thrown in there that you kind of just bring your own meaning because I think everybody took drugs when they made this movie. You have to realize that going in. This is a drug movie that's packaged as a whimsical kids film almost. You know, you can find it around the country in 50th anniversary showings. I know it's showing in Columbus, Ohio over at the Gateway Film Center. So, hey, here's your chance to see it on the big screen. If you've never seen it, it's worth seeing, even if you don't get it or understand it. So I'm going to have to say Yellow Submarine rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need a good old break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ant-Man and the Wasp and Whitney.
We all live in the Yellow Submarine. Yellow Submarine. Yellow Submarine. We all...
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Ant-Man is put under house arrest for helping Captain America during the Marvel Civil War, but he is sprung by Hank Pym and his daughter trying to bring Pym's lost wife out of the quantum realm.
Dr. Pym, I actually heard what happened to you. You opened up the quantum realm. That's when this crazy creepy ghost who like walks through walls and stuff stole your tech. And now she wants to take over the world or whatever. Who would have believed that in your hour of need, you would turn to us?
Not me. The only chance you've got is both of you.
Ant-Man and the Wasp teaming up.
This is actually the first Marvel movie since Infinity War. do not expect any sort of wrap up with Infinity War. Don't even expect any real nod, really, to Infinity War. This is a self-contained movie, very much like the first Ant-Man was. I really enjoyed the first Ant-Man, actually. There's several reasons why I liked the first Ant-Man. And I know there's a lot of people in film circles, sort of like the film Twitter group, that still have a bone to pick with the fact that Edgar Wright never did Ant-Man, the movie. But I think that that was good, because what Edgar Wright would have delivered would not have been what Marvel wanted, and you would have ended up with a kind of a solo issue that you had with Star Wars at this point. Ant-Man is still the lowest grossing, it may even be the lowest grossing internationally, of the Marvel movies post-Avengers in 2012. I still enjoyed it, and it still made like $500 million worldwide. It still was a success. I liked the first Ant-Man because it was self-contained. It was small. You came right off of Age of Ultron, where they were once again blowing up a whole city, literally lifting it off the ground, and that movie was so bloated with so many characters and not held together very well. And now you just ended up with Ant-Man, which was a fun little whimsical, almost a comedy, really. I mean, it's as much a comedy as an action movie. And a lot of it's because Paul Rudd does that sort of comedic, sarcastic styling, which falls in line with Star-Lord and falls in line with Tony Stark. So it's not an unheard of type of response to superhero powers. But it wasn't meant to be anything more than just a one-off origin story. And that's kind of the charm of the first Ant-Man. It is self-contained. It is small. It is something that isn't as bombastic and heavy. And you get the same thing following Infinity War, which was so heavy and intense and complex and had so many characters to it. Here you've just got these group of people kind of knocking around trying to shrink down and save somebody in the quantum realm. And yeah, that's out there and bizarre and weird. I didn't realize how goofy this movie sounded until I was doing radio interviews to review it, and I kept trying to blurb it, as I just did here, where I'm like, going down to the quantum realm, that's goofy. But that's okay. You never would think, you know, Marvel is able to do this now with a movie because people can accept it. It's kind of like when Pixar did Inside Out. They could not have led with Inside Out. They had to lead with Toy Story. Paul Rudd is still great as the Ant-Man character. And in a lot of ways, it's not even his movie. It's a little bit more of not the Wasp. Everyone's saying, oh, it's the female-centric, first female superhero kind of getting lead in the movie. Yes and no. I mean, we got Captain Marvel coming up, and you've got Brie Larson playing her. So that's probably, I would say, that's the Wonder Woman stepping stone that Marvel's doing. Evangeline Lilly is a title character. She is probably as more significant into the story because it's her mother who's trapped down there. But you also have Michael Douglas. Really, it's kind of an ensemble, a very small ensemble of just a handful of people. But overall, I mean, it's more of a duo. It's more of a Batman and Robin kind of thing. And that's kind of fun. I have to admit, I like that in the movie. And I like the fact that it's just as much a comedy as the first one was. And same thing, you saw that with Thor Ragnarok, where that was very much a broad comedy. That was goofy and silly and over the top, and I laughed as much as I was thrilled in that movie. Same thing with this one, just because they use the not just the sarcasm and the wisecracking of Ant-Man, but you use this weird things getting big and hitting people, you know, like a Pez container, that kind of stuff. That's what kind of makes the movie somewhat silly. And again, that's why I like this direction that the Marvel movies go, is that they're not this heavy, dark. And it's also a sequel. A lot of times the sequels tend to get darker. You saw that with Thor the Dark World. You saw that with Captain America Winter Soldier. You know, when they have those direct sequels, they tend to be darker, grimmer, and they're having to deal with real issues. And this was still just a fun, whimsical film. I enjoyed it. I think it's what summer movies are meant to be. So, yeah, I really enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp. I'm going to say totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Whitney. This documentary examines the life and career of music superstar Whitney Houston.
There were times when I would look up at the God and I'd go, why is this happening to me?
I come from a family of singers.
My mom, she was a little tough on Whitney because she knew what Whitney had.
There were always a lot of secrets. When you don't resolve things and you don't deal with things,
never go away.
I don't really need to look.
Why didn't Sissy do more?
What was Whitney's drug of choice?
What was it that drove them apart?
How much do you think you spent?
Did John ever try and get rid of Robin?
Were they in love?
Now, this is directed by Kevin MacDonald, who did movies like Last King of Scotland. So, I mean, he comes from a serious line of filmmaking. He is not just some VH1 behind the music director who gets a shot at doing a big time movie, even though that's essentially what this is. It's a behind the music type movie. I mean, I'm not saying that to marginalize the movie, but when you have music documentaries, they do follow a formula. And if you've watched any of the behind, it's a sort of like Biography or E, The True Hollywood Story. There is a formula that has been developed over the years. And in general, a lot of musicians follow this same trajectory. Young, kind of comes on strong, has immense talent, becomes very famous, tries to continue the fame, and then there's eventually a downfall, oftentimes a death. You saw that with Michael Jackson. But this one is, your basic starts off as this very hot young talent, and what I found most interesting was the stuff before that, who she was growing up, and the fact that she did come from a show business family. I mean, her aunt's Dionne Warwick, her mom sang backup for Aretha Franklin. So she doesn't come to this ignorantly. She didn't come to this cold. She wasn't just somebody from, father wasn't a butcher and her mom wasn't a preschool teacher, and then she suddenly blew up. No, I mean, they knew the business, and in fact, they kind of groom her. And that's kind of interesting to watch, all that intimate backstory that you get from the family in the interviews. When she becomes famous, there's a little bit more known about her, and you watch her rise to fame, and unfortunately, like most stories, you throw that much money at fame at somebody in their 20s, it usually doesn't end well, and it didn't for her. And they do deal with the very dark post-90s life that she had. They also focus a lot, especially in the last half, on Bobby Brown, and sort of the narrative that everybody accepts is that Whitney Houston was this wonderful, talented American girl, wholesome and beautiful, and then was corrupted by Bobby Brown. And the one thing that they do correct in this narrative is that's not the case. She was dealing with a lot of this stuff even before she met Bobby Brown. Now, that doesn't excuse anything that Bobby Brown did, and they do delve into a lot of the dark ends of that. But these were things that were already in Whitney Houston's life, and they were going to be a problem for her regardless of who she married. And they also explain the reason why she was attracted to Bobby Brown. We never got that as just the average public that didn't understand where her background really was and why she was attracted to him in particular. And then they go through that and they explain it. And that's, I think, the most interesting stuff. Ultimately, this is a well-made movie, but it's there for the fans of Whitney Houston because it gives a broad look at her life. It does have some, what I would say, questionable facts in it. I mean, it overstates The Bodyguard as a significant movie, you know, the stuff like that. And I really don't think that The Bodyguard was that big of a movie outside of Whitney Houston and her family's perception. But that's just me. Overall, it's well made, and like I said, the fans of her are going to enjoy it. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office, and I'm going to review two things from home cinema. One, The China Hustle, which is on demand, and The Cured, which is on DVD and Blu-ray. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews. I'm actually going to lean into a movie that technically would fall into the home cinema roundup. And that movie is The China Hustle. It actually originally came out in March. This unflinching documentary takes a look at the explosion of Chinese companies traded on the American Stock Exchange and the rampant fraud that resulted.
What is capitalism? It rewards those who work hard, but it also rewards those who take advantage of others.
After the mortgage crisis in 08,
everybody's looking to get their money back. China's this exploding market.
It blew my mind.
Let's invest in it now.
Everybody thought, I want to be a part of the China growth story.
We're making a profit. $22 million, $100 million,
$20 billion,
$50 billion.
This was simply too good to be true. And it was.
This film is put together by the same people who did Enron, the smartest guys in the room. This looks at the dangers of dealing in some of these financial structures. And one of the problems with movies like this is explaining the science of the money to everybody, or just the jargon, or even the details of the money. Because if you're not in finance, you don't know how this stuff works. But these movies do deal with stuff that affect people, because your mutual fund are run by the people who commit fraud, and some of them may be run by people who commit fraud in these companies. And very much like the movies that were made about the housing collapse back in 2008, dramatic films, you know, narrative films like The Big Short, take a long time to try and explain it. And there's a great scene in The Big Short where Margot Robbie's in a bathtub trying to explain how the money works, because it is something that people can get lost in the numbers. The China Hustle specifically looks at the boom of Chinese companies that found their way onto the American Stock Exchange by a thing called a reverse merger, which is basically a way to back end a company onto the stock exchange without getting vetted. And it's about these people who discovered it. And then, of course, they were, you know, I mean, they wanted a profit as well. So they found a way to sell short in these companies and made money doing it, but were also blowing the whistle. So no, there's no real good guys in this movie. It shows how the financial world is susceptible to fraud. This does spark political discussions, because people are like, stocks and finances, and that runs and generates our industry, and it does generate the foundation of our economy. And they're right. You can't get rid of stocks. You can't get rid of the New York Stock Exchange. That helps burn the economy. That helps things move. That helps everybody, really, when the stock market does well. But the flip side is, when the stock market doesn't do well, when the stock market crashes or even has a recession or has a dip, that can have a huge impact on your average person, not just because of the cost of bread and milk at the store, but because your finances are tied up. Your retirement is tied up in the stock market, even if you're not personally investing. And we also saw that at the end of the 90s with the implosion of the dot-coms, and you saw that multiple times around just in my lifetime, all the way going back to the collapse of the savings and loans that they had in the 80s. This is important to other people, even if you don't personally trade in the stock market, and it's worth seeing a movie like this. Because here's the thing, as much good as the financial world and like the New York Stock Exchange and the financial trade, as much as that's good for the economy and good for America, it's also a danger, because anytime there is access to money, you will get fraud. It doesn't matter where that is, whether it's in the stock exchange or whether it's, you know, like we in Ohio, we just had there was a big scandal with the readily available funds for online classrooms, which has nothing to do with finances, but there was funds available and people took advantage of it. So that's why you need oversight. And if anything, this movie shows the necessity for oversight, because you can spin a tale and you can spin fraud and then get out before the entire thing collapses. And that's what happened with the housing crisis. That's what happened with the buying on margin when you look back in the crash of 29. These movies break it down extremely well, and that's why they're important. It reminds me of the time I used to work for WorldCom. WorldCom pumped up its stock, and it talks about how they used people to pump up their stock. And you also saw this in movies like The Big Short, which it describes the financial crisis in 2008. These companies would pump up their stock by a supposedly disinterested third party. But in my case, I remember sitting there with WorldCom stock, and I found out that one of the companies that was pumping up the stock was basically the one that was in charge of brokering all of the stock option deals. It's that kind of hands in different cookie jars that is rife for fraud. And that's why the China Hustle's worth seeing. It's very worth seeing, especially now as we're entering into a trade war with China. This shows how the Chinese business does not work the same way American business does. And we can't just assume that they're going to have the same checks and balances that we do, even if we don't have those balances. Anyways, The China Hustle is a great movie. You should check it out. It's worth seeing, especially if you own anything that is remotely considered a 401k or any sort of mutual fund. The China Hustle rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really quickly on the box office. Last week, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, it did about $60 million, which is almost a 60% drop, which is on par with those kind of movies and that kind of a big opening weekend. This is still, in my opinion, underperforming. As a sequel to such a massive movie, this should have done better. Now, it's doing well overseas, but we know that movies going overseas, a lot of times, as much as everyone says, international audiences are more refined, they like garbage just as much as the Americans do. That's why the Fast and Furious movies do so well, and the Transformers movies do so well, is they kind of transcend language barriers because they're just big, bombastic action movies. And that's essentially what Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is. I'm curious to see what the next one does and how far that one's going to dip. Both Sicario 2 and Uncle Drew actually kind of overperformed a bit, $19 million and $15 million. That's not bad. This week, of course, Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to do well. It did very well in previews. Actually, Ant-Man and the Wasp did better in previews than Ant-Man did, and it's topping off a lot of other movies, and I think it's winning that momentum from Infinity War, which, like I said, they don't clear anything up. A lot of people were interested in Infinity War, and that rolls into this one. It's the opposite of what we saw happen with The Last Jedi and Solo. Last Jedi disappointed a lot of people and kind of killed some people's taste for Star Wars, and I think that made Solo suffer more than anything else. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The movie I want to spotlight on this is The Cured from IFC Films and Shout Factory. In the aftermath of a zombie outbreak, 75% of the infected are cured but must face the guilt of being able to remember everything they did while they were out of control.
How long were you infected?
4 years.
You're having any violent impulses?
No.
Your sister-in-law has agreed to take you in.
Smile, Killian.
Are you one of the cured?
Yeah.
Will you be sick again?
Sometimes I feel it.
Screaming to get out.
How could you take one in? They're murderers, the lot of them.
They want us all dead.
Overall, I am so tired of zombie movies. To me, very little new stuff is being done in zombie movies. Most zombie movies just the same old that we've seen before. Either just an excuse to have the rampant zombie violence, or it's just misery porn. And that's my problem with The Walking Dead. It's just people moping around, and I'm just like, well, just kill yourself already. You guys are boring and awful, and I can't stand any of the characters. Just give yourself to the zombies. Become a walking buffet, which they kind of do. This one, at least they're trying to do something a little bit different with this one, and there is a sort of that... I find it a unique aspect. I actually wrote a story like this. You can get that on Amazon. Just go to Amazon and search. It's called Not the End, and it's a book I wrote. It's a short novella, but deals with similar concepts. The thing with this movie is it's so dour, and I just don't care about the characters. I can't find any sympathy for them. And all the action stuff, all the good stuff that would happen is all just talked about. What would have been interesting is the stuff that happens leading up to this. And this is meant to be the emotional fallout from it, because this guy goes home and he had killed his brother, but his sister-in-law doesn't know that he actually did when he was a zombie. And it's an interesting setup, but it's just there to be punishing and brutal. And I never found that interesting in movies. There's still so much cliche in this when it comes to a zombie movie, because there's not much to a zombie movie. That's the problem. Zombie movies are very straightforward and at times kind of boring, at least in my opinion. I know they're popular, but I think they're coming down in popularity. Anyways, I have to say The Cure kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Other releases this week include Blockers, Beirut and 7 Days in Entebbe, which are kind of an interesting pairing of movies themselves, and another Wolf Cop, because we need another one of those movies. Anyways, that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Hotel Transylvania 3 and Skyscraper. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.